The Wheel of Shame, written and performed by Robert Crichton. Molly tended to live in a world of her very own, populated by imaginary friends and inanimate objects, which would talk to her and keep her company. But Molly was tired of being all by herself and so asked to have a hamster. Her parents hadn't agreed, but her pleas fell on the open ears of Great-Uncle Frank, who took the task in hand and purchased a cage, tubes and runs, the inevitable wheel, and, crucially, a hamster to inhabit this brave new world of pet care. The hamster was brought to Molly with much ceremony on the occasion of the anniversary of her birth. Her great-uncle Frank had arrived, unannounced, and presented Molly and her parents with a fait accompli, which now had to be christened with some kind of a name. The hamster was very hamster-like, so she called it Hamster. Molly was imaginative that way. Having named him, Molly then rushed to get to know this new friend well, though sadly her approach was ill-judged. Hamsters are nocturnal by nature, and not all that keen with the whole daytime playing around thing. So whilst Molly whooped and cried and clutched, Hamster, being a hamster, did as hamsters do, and bit her. A blossoming friendship between Beauty and the Beast this was not to be. Molly screamed and howled while Mum and Dad soothed and calmed, telling her to be gentle with the little mite, and that she shouldn't cry, not on her birthday. Nobody should cry on their birthday. It wasn't allowed. Kiss it better, barely a mark at all. Luckily, Molly wasn't a child to hold a grudge long, and she didn't want to seem ungrateful to her uncle, so she was quickly persuaded to not hate Hamster, but their relationship was never to go beyond a qualified friendship, civil but distinct from love. Their parentally brokered peace negotiations went from tentative stroking to holding in her hands to something like play, something very like play, but this playtime was hampered by Hamster's tendency to spend most of his life, as Molly saw it, asleep. Except when Molly wanted to sleep herself, of course. Then Hamster was the life and soul of the party, running, forever running on the wheel, the ever-turning wheel, turning slow, slow, fast, fast, fasty, fasty, fast, fast. It was on a Tuesday that this story really turned sour. Molly's best friend, well, let's be kind, her only friend, Abigail, the girl who lived next door, had come over to play. Abigail was, in Molly's eyes, the coolest person ever. She even had a cat that was really bad-tempered, which was amazing in a slightly scary way. After school, dull school day ending over, they retired to Molly's to play, at Abigail's suggestion, with Hamster. As they went to open the cage, Abigail asked Molly, "Shall we shut the door in case he gets out?" But Molly said, "No, no, it'll be fine. Hamster never does anything. Come on." But what Molly didn't take into account was that the curtains in her room were still closed, the day was more than usually overcast, and the effect that the clamour of young female voices would have on the fight-or-flight reflex of an untrusting rodent. No sooner did Molly say, "Hello, Hamster!" than Hamster was up, off, and out of the room before you could say, "Should have shut the door." Molly and Abigail hunted for Hamster in the calm and controlled fashion of newly teenaged girls, screaming at the top of their voices and running round the landing of the house with heavy, inexpert feet, trampling forward and back to rescue him from the big, bad world. But Hamster, being a hamster, could not grasp their altruistic concern, so he sped from corner to corner till his inexperienced rescuers lost sight of him, and then of each other, as Molly was left guarding the landing while Abigail searched the bathroom. Molly was just about to join Abigail when Hamster suddenly came shooting out right at her, coming straight for her little feet, and Molly, not even thinking about it, not realizing what she was doing, lifted her right foot and squash. Molly stood there, her right foot now a furry slipper, taking in the full import of what had just happened. Hamster was, hang on.
Yep, definitely dead.
And at that moment her dad came out of his room. Molly's dad worked nights and was still due another hour's sleep, and his untidy hair made him look very angry. He was himself a giant nocturnal hamster of a dad, liable to bite if riled. Molly was sure he could see under her shoe. Molly was sure he could see the guilt burning there. But his anger tuned down to irritation when Abigail ran out of the bathroom saying, "Hamster's run away!" Molly continued to stand there, hoping that no one would look down at her feet. Needing a distraction quickly, Molly pointed and cried, "Look, he's just run into the bathroom!" prompting Abigail and Dad to engage pursuit. The moment their backs were turned, Molly peeled the slimline corpse of Hamster from her shoe, ran into her room, and tossed the lifeless frisbee of fur out of her window. Checking her shoe for bloodstains, Molly rejoined her best friend and her dad in the bathroom. They were still busy searching when Dad said, "You should have made sure the door was shut." "I did," said Molly. "I told Abigail we should shut the door." Abigail stared at Molly in horror at her betrayal, mirroring Molly's own surprise at this rash passing of the guilt. Abigail was her best friend, and she, Molly, had betrayed her. Abigail bawled out that it wasn't true, Molly, that it was. And a screaming match of intense decibelic proportions rang out through the house, and Dad had little choice but to insist that it didn't matter now, please stop. Which they did. But the two girls barely looked at one another. The best friends were sundered. Dad, by dint of age, if not experience in the subtle art of small-game hamster hunting, shut all the doors, ushered the shimmering feud of girls downstairs, and drinking milk and cookies, before suggesting that if they were really quiet and left a cookie for Hamster, he might come out. Molly said that wouldn't work, then remembered that they didn't know that he was dead, so she said it was a really good idea, and seeing the narrowed eyes of Abigail, suggested they place the cookies together? A token peace offering. Abigail agreed, but for no peace, only so that when they were out of the earshot of Dad, she could tell Molly that their friendship was officially over. Molly was too shell-shocked by the day to even cry, especially as her betrayal was not yet complete. They went back downstairs and into the kitchen. Looking out of the kitchen window, Molly said as casually as she could, almost as if it were true, "Oh, look, Abigail. I can see your cat in the garden." Abigail ran to the back door and went outside. "Oh, it's run away," said Molly quickly, and then, looking down at the patio underneath her bedroom window, she screamed. Her dad came running out, and Molly was crying, and Abigail was left beside the body of Hamster, obviously cut short in his prime. A very unnatural death. "Abigail's cat ate Hamster, look!" wailed Molly. Oh, the bitter, cruel web that children weave. It is not the purpose of this story to describe the recrimination that ensued, the returning of Abigail to her home next door, and the battle of parents and child. Needless to say, both girls went to bed traumatized, and both sets of parents deeply embarrassed by it all. Calm after the storm in the teacup, night fell, and Molly, feeling elated and sick at the same time, just didn't know how to go to sleep. It had been too crazy. The house had fallen silent. There was no one to talk to. Even if she could dare to share, Dad had gone to work, and Mum had tucked her in, kiss, kiss, good night, leaving her alone in the dark with her deeds. The moment Mum had gone, she de-hid from her bedding the damp tissues she'd stolen away at toothy brush time and systematically began to clean the underside of her guilty shoe. As she battled the imagined stain, Molly also took arms against her conscience, which was under siege by circumstance. She wasn't a bad person, she told herself repeatedly. Abigail wasn't a good friend. She was weird, nasty, and she smelled of cat, of wet cat, of wet cat poo. Fear, guilt, grief even fought for control of Molly. In the end, her pride and her cowardice won, and so she climbed back into bed and hid under the covers. Molly was just drifting off when a noise caught her ear, a rustle. A rustle in the darkness. It was nothing, she thought. It was just Hamster in his cage. And then she remembered that Hamster was dead. Rigid she lay, waiting, listening for another sound. Nothing stirred beyond the slight motion of Molly's stifled breathing. In, out, in, out, in, out, sigh, len, s. Molly started to relax. And there it was again. A rustle in the bedding of the hamster cage. Something shifting. Slowly she strained to lift the covers from off her head. The air was cool and fresh upon her face, and she was sharply aware just how hot and uncomfortable it had been hiding under the duvet. She lifted her head slightly to look at the hopefully empty cage, peering into the darkness, eyes seeing only different shades of the dark, the cage, and in semi-silhouette, the wheel. And as she thought about the wheel, it started to move, the accusing squeak turning slow, slow, fast, fast, fasty, fasty, fast, fast. It even spun in Hamster's signature style of spin. But as she stared at the grey shadow of a wheel, Molly knew that there should be something inside. And there wasn't. Molly didn't scream. She couldn't scream because that would make it real. That would make her guilty. That would wake Mum. That would brand her, in Mum's eyes, in everyone's eyes, as one with a guilty soul. She leant very carefully across to her new bedside lamp, never taking her eyes off the spinning wheel. On! The moment the light flooded the room, the wheel stopped, dead stop. And Molly sat up. No noise. No movement. After a little bit of silent staring, where Molly decided there couldn't have been anything there, she risked switching off the light again. Immediately the wheel turned slow, slow, fast, fast, furious, angry. With a squeal of panic, Molly had the light back on again, and again all movement stopped. Well, if that was the game, then Molly would wait it out. Her pride remerged, and she decided she could stay up. It was only 7:30, she could stay up all night. So Molly got herself settled in for the long struggle, propping herself up with pillows, facing the cage. And she did quite well, for half an hour. But then, as time passed, she permitted herself to relax, got a little more comfy, snuggled down a bit, asleep. She woke in the dark. Her lamp was off. Mum must have seen the light, tucked her in and left. And worse, she had been awoken by the rattle of a wheel. In her blind panic, she hadn't worried about making noise, and her scramble for the light was loud in the night. Worse still, her mum had obviously only just that moment tucked her in, and at the noise she came hurrying back. "Are you all right, dear?" she mum probed. "Your light was on." "I'm fine." "You sure?" "Yes." "Nothing bothering you?" "No, nothing." "Because you can tell me there isn't anything." "Well, good night then." The light was off, the door shut, and Molly was alone in the dark with the cage. Silent and still, a minute passed. Two. An age in miniature.
"Well, get on with it," Molly hissed, sitting up. "Squeak around in your cage all you like, I don't care, you can't scare me."
She was clearly wrong there, as she visibly jumped when the wheel shot round at a speed that broke Hamster's personal best and one or two laws of motion. But after that initial shock of expectant surprise, Molly relaxed. Was that all it could do? Spin? Well, spin on, little hamster, spin on. And it did. And though Molly wasn't scared anymore, she didn't get any sleep, either. The next morning, Molly dragged herself down to breakfast, exhausted and unhappy, but still pride-driven to silence. School was to be lived through, a tunnel of over-hot, sleep-deprived anxiety. Abigail pointedly didn't look at her, and it seemed that the whole school knew what she had done. But after school, home safe, Molly flopped down onto the sofa, primarily to sleep, but her mum, perhaps worried at her silence, kept trying to coax her daughter into some kind of talk. As she avoided the questioning parent, Molly kept seeing, half-seeing, movement out of the corner of her eye, a quick flash of nothing. She ignored it, stared ahead, and tried to not listen to mum. Then she felt something crawling on her shoulder. "Ah, get off me!" she screamed, leaping up, but of course, there was nothing there. She stopped, frozen, looking at her mum, who was frowning big mum furrows. "I wasn't touching you, dear. Is there something wrong?" "Nothing." But as she said it, she felt a bite, a little hamster bite on her little finger. "Ow, stop it!" "What is it?" her mum asked. "Hamster bit me," Molly cried, before remembering. But before she could come up with a better excuse, the bites continued, harder this time, more cruel, more insistent. "Bite, stop it! Bite, stop it! Bite, stop it!" Her tearaway dance performance before mum earned her a one-way trip to her room. "Move directly to room, do not pass go, do not collect £200.
"No, please don't send me up there," she begged.
"Why?" her mum returned.
"I can't tell you," she whined,
until the full force of mumness compelled her up those stairs. The bedroom door slammed behind her.
"Don't leave me in here."
"You will stay in there," the door-muffled reply came, "until you tell me what is going on."
"I can't."
And as those last desperate cries of pride escaped her, she could hear the wheel turning, turning, slow, slow, fast, fast, fasty, fasty, fast, fast. At the same time, there was something running across the floor. No, over there, always out of the corner of the eye. How many of him were there? Then the nipping at her fingers started again, and Molly gave in.
"All right, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry."
And Molly fell into an hysterical heap of guilt and tears, hardly noticing the door had opened so that mum and awoken dad could watch the scene. Of course, the parents had known that there was something more to the tale of the dead hamster than Molly had let on. Even the layperson could tell that hamster couldn't have been killed by a cat unless the cat possessed a steamroller. But they hadn't bargained on the full story coming out via a poltergeist, or discovering the dark wickedness of their offspring, especially as the truth meant kowtowing, grovelling apologies to the family Abigail, and the stress-fracturing of family time as punishment, or would have done, if it weren't for the unfortunate reality of the haunting encroaching on their lives. Everyone, Molly especially, expected hope. Everything would return to normal. She had confessed, the ghost had avenged his death, but sadly for the child dreams of Molly, this isn't a morality tale. Stuff happens, and just because it's neat, that doesn't mean that's how the story should end. All would have returned to normal if the phantom of Molly's hamster had gone quietly. Obviously, once Molly confessed, though their belief in the phantom hamster was thin, still they threw away the cage and all the hamster fun factory paraphernalia. But even though there was no wheel to spin, in the night, the squeak of a wheel could still be heard, and not just by Molly now, by Mum, and during the day by Dad, and worst of all week, by everyone on the street as far as the newsagents on still days. The sound slow, fast. As the neighbours began to talk, and in the case of the family Abigail complain, the reality of the hyper-dead hamster caught them out. So whenever they explained about the ghost to an outsider, they had to speak of a rodent problem, an infestation. It wasn't supernatural, it was an infestation, which it was, in a sense, only the rodent problem couldn't be trapped and killed, as it was already dead. Despite choosing to label their problem natural and suffering social opprobrium for their trouble, the noise and primarily the lack of sleep drove them to call in an exorcist. Now, getting an exorcist wasn't as difficult as they at first feared. They just asked the local vicar, who agreed to come round and investigate. The vicar's investigation technique involved wandering from room to room, eyes half closed, arms slightly raised, and looking a bit mental, in a nice, non-aggressive Church of England way. When the noises started, the vicar's eyes snapped wide open in surprise. This was his first haunting, and it was very exciting. The vicar said a few prayers, and the noise increased. Positively beaming with enthusiasm, he led them downstairs, saying he would make a call to higher powers. No, not specifically him upstairs, but the Bishop of Deliverance. The bishop had a waiting list, so they shouldn't expect anything soon. And there was an enormous shortage of exorcists. The demand of ghosts and demonic possessions outstripped the supply of exorcists the various churches could provide. So the next few weeks were very frustrating for the family, as the vicar kept moving back the date for their exorcism. In desperation, they started hunting out other solutions. Dad discovered, whilst trawling the internet, that there was a correspondence course in exorcism from America, which he suggested he could complete part-time. Both Mum and Molly gave him a withering look at that. A man who was afraid of upsetting waiters was hardly the man to tackle a ghost, even the ghost of a hamster. Mum had a more immediate success, having got the number of a local spiritualist from one of her acquaintances. On a cold call, Mum asked what she knew about ghosts. The spiritualist said she could probably help a bit, and at the very least she might be able to find something out about the nature of the spirit. The spiritualist sounded perfectly normal over the phone, and seemed perfectly normal when she came round. There were none of the suspect bangles, pronounced teeth, or thick glasses that one comes to expect from nutters. Having asked to be told nothing in advance to avoid being loaded up with naughty suggestions, she slowly wandered through the house, waving her arms about in a very general way. Mum and Dad had to admit that she did look a bit odd, but no more than the vicar had before her. After careful examination of the house, she spent a long time looking at Molly, again waving her arms about. Molly, unimpressed at this reading of her aura, just gave the stranger her best Paddington Bear stare. Molly was then sent to bed so that the spiritualist could speak to Mum and Dad alone. Naturally, she didn't go to bed at all and sat at the top of the landing, listening to everything. "Now," said the spiritualist, "I'm afraid you do appear to have what foolish people call a poltergeist. It isn't evil, a demon or something, it's just a lost soul, a person trapped between then and now." Mum coughed. "But a poltergeist? Of a hamster?" "No, it's not about the hamster. The hamster was just the trigger. The death of the hamster, the guilt and the lies it provoked, opened Molly up to become a conduit for this lost spirit." "But does that mean," asked Mum, "that Molly's possessed?"
On the landing, Molly grew rather excited. She was possessed. Cool. Not at all, said the spiritualist, bursting Molly's bubble. This often happens to young girls or boys just starting puberty. They are teeming with energy. So is Molly causing this? Again, Molly felt the excitement building. She had magical powers. Not at all, said the spiritualist, causing Molly to curse her inwardly. She knew this woman was an idiot. It's not a conscious act. She doesn't cause it any more than a cable causes the electricity to travel along it. There sometimes appears to be a connection with the mind, but it's illusory, just an expression of psychic Tourette's. There isn't necessarily a deliberateness between her and the happenings at all. She is just the conduit for powerful psychic forces. What can we do? The worried parents asked. Well, this is all perfectly normal. You must understand growing pains. The easiest thing to do is to channel the natural anxiety she has about growing up elsewhere. She might grow out of it, but that could take years. So what can we do? The parents' fear asked again. Molly almost joined in. Well, I know this is a bit drastic, but the best thing to do, and I've successfully implemented this with other clients, is for you to encourage Molly to develop a good eating disorder. It'll be easier to moderate than self-harming, and cheaper, as you don't have to stock up on razor blades, and your food bills will go down by quite a bit. Just encourage her to worry about her figure, her appearance, leave magazines around the house, and try, and this is very important, try to disapprove of her eating habits. Anything to help undermine her self-esteem. If you channel all her fears and anxieties about growing up into a carefully chosen neuroses, then she will close herself off. Push all that naughty energy inwards, not outwards. She'll be so worried about people judging her, she'll have nothing left to create a supernatural event. Not only that, she'll probably become more popular at school. Pardon? Oh, you would like me to leave now. I understand. No need to thank me. I'm here to help. Call me any time. The spiritualist was escorted off the premises with fixed politeness, and Molly crept to bed, contemplating her stomach. She knew all about eating disorders, of course. Georgina claimed she'd been bulimic since she was 5, and Sophia told her she once tried to throw up after a lunch break, but couldn't face sticking her fingers that far. Perhaps all the other girls were doing it, and that's why Molly and Molly alone was a conduit for her hamster. She decided that, though this woman was clearly stupid, it might be an idea to give the eating disorder a go, if only to get some sleep. Whilst Molly's parents didn't know that their daughter was taking a crash course in self-induced vomiting, they could see that she wasn't herself any more. They phoned the vicar, expressing their concern, but he said that he still hadn't got them a date for a deliverance, but if they wanted to pray at the church, any time, and on Sundays, of course, that might be a help. Perhaps it was this sense of desperation that led to Dad casting a long shot. He'd found a sort of exorcist online. He was one Reverend Rice, a preacher from America. Mum had previously vetoed their getting in touch, but he was in the country doing a tour, and an email couldn't do any harm. To Dad's amazement, the Reverend said he would be in the area that week. A few furtive phone calls later, and the Reverend Rice was booked to help, by which time Mum couldn't complain. When the Reverend came round, he was everything you might expect from an American, in that he was immensely fat. What they didn't expect was the film crew that followed him. The family and the Reverend sat down with his agent, his personal stylist, his PR person, the director, and Ted, his personal bodyguard. The Reverend explained that this was a documentary crew, and that he would do the exorcism for free, so long as they didn't mind being filmed. Forms were signed, hands were shaken, and the Reverend went to get changed in his Winnebago. Molly and the family were then attacked by makeup. I thought this was a documentary, Dad said. Oh, it is, but these days we stage it a bit, said the stylist. We want everyone to look their best. Well, nothing we can do about the teeth. Keep the mouth closed when you smile. They were ushered to the kitchen, which had in their absence been cleared of clutter
and seen the addition of several tasteful potted plants. Sitting round the kitchen table, cameras at a discreet distance, the Reverend ignored the parents, addressing Molly exclusively. "Now, Molly, tell me, when did you first notice the noises?"
"After I killed my hamster," said Molly.
"You killed your hamster?"
"Yes, I trod on him. Now he's haunting our house. Except he's not really. He just opened me up to be a conduit for his lost soul, and I'm causing it all."
"Really?" said the Reverend, changing the look of triumph in his eyes to concern with professional speed.
"Yes, then they told me I needed to take up an eating disorder, so I've been practicing vomiting. Look!"
And Molly made thrust a finger down her throat. The Reverend, with the speed his enormous bulk seemed to deny, jumped up, holding a crucifix in one hand and a Bible in the other, crying out,
"Begone, Satan, from this child!"
The camera crew shifted to one side to get the full view of Molly having her face pushed back by the book. Molly's parents, confused and sleep-deprived, were not quick enough to stop this, and the Reverend could count himself lucky for the delay, for in those seconds before Molly's dad could punch his lights out, Molly had fallen to the floor in convulsions of near-hysterical laughter. The Reverend, feeling that this wasn't quite the reaction he'd hoped for, called again, "Satan, begone!" But Molly found this even funnier the second time, and the Reverend tried a third and a fourth time to cast out the demons before asking, "What are you laughing at, child?"
"You're funny,"
said Molly, between laughs. By now, Dad was well over boiling point, but found he was being held back from violence by Ted, the personal bodyguard.
"You don't want to do that, sir."
The Reverend ignored the scuffle, speaking to the director. "Did we get all that?" "Enough," the director replied. And before Mum or Dad had a chance to demand it, everyone started to leave. Dad tried to follow, intending to give them a piece of his mind, but Ted was still there, blocking his way.
"You sign the contract, sir. You let this happen. Don't make any trouble."
"Does this happen often?"
"Always. They only wanted something dramatic to fill the last 3 minutes. Have a nice day."
And with a shrug, Ted followed the crew out. Mum was trying to calm down Molly, who was still laughing hysterically.
"Can you believe that?" Dad cried.
"Shh," said Mum. "This is the first laugh we've had from her for weeks." So Molly and her parents were to some degree happy. They'd even gained half a dozen potted plants. But the noises of the hamster in the night time were still there. Finally, they got the Bishop of Deliverance round, who was a nice chap, again very understanding, but he did have a diocese meeting at 5, so if they could get on with the exorcism, sorry, deliverance. For Molly and her parents, the practice of exorcism was all rather dull. The priests prayed, and prayed a bit more. And that was about it. They did nothing with Molly, but focused on the landing and her room, where the noises were now very loud indeed. Mum and Dad decided it was best to keep Molly away, and asked her great-uncle Frank round to look after her. So whilst Mum and Dad assisted the priests in the bedroom, great-uncle Frank, grey-haired and kindly as ever, took Molly out into the garden to talk about hamster.
I'm sorry about squishing your hamster,"
Molly whispered.
"It was your hamster to squish," he replied good-naturedly. "But, my dear, you have created quite a problem."
"I didn't mean to,"
she protested.
"I know that, my dear. But you've got a bit of an infestation here, haven't you?"
"Yes," said Molly. "They're sorting it out now." Great-uncle Frank laughed.
"I doubt it. They don't know what they're doing. The only way to capture a rodent, ghostly or otherwise, is with a trap, stands to reason. You see this?"
And great-uncle Frank held up a small, spring-loaded mouse trap. Molly nodded.
"This is a normal trap, no good for ghosts. What you need is a ghost trap. You know how to make one of those?"
Molly shook her head.
Well, first I want you to close your eyes. No peeking. Now imagine a trap like this one with your mind. Get a good look at it. Good. Now I want you to put down some bait. What kind of things do ghost hamsters like to eat?
Broccoli, said Molly, without hesitation.
Broccoli it is, then. Put your broccoli on the trap in your head. Then put the trap on the patio. Good. Now just pull the spring back in your mind and set the trap for going. Good. That's grand. Now open your eyes. Can you still see the trap?
And Molly had to say she did. A large hamster trap, laden with a vast sprig of broccoli on the pedal.
Now what? Asked Molly.
Now, said Great Uncle Frank, we wait.
Upstairs in the house, the poltergeist and the priests were engaged in a running battle. The ever-present squeaking had grown to deafening at their prayers, overwhelming them with never-ending turns of the invisible wheel and the thumping rustle of unfeet through non-existent sawdust. Mum and Dad chanted their prayer harder, the priests forcing the pace, looking more fierce, growing louder. Books on the shelves started to shake. Little ladybird books shuddered and took flight, gracing glancing blows upon the two men. The lights in the house began to flicker, and then, from nowhere, or possibly the patio below, there came the sound of a loud snap and an eerie
squeak,
and everything was still. In the congratulations that followed, no one noticed Great Uncle Frank holding the sobbing Molly as she stared at the invisible trap she had created and the invisible body of the hamster that she knew was there.